This is the Middle East Monitor Podcast from the Voice of America. I'm Paul Westfeeling in the VOA News Center in Washington. The start of talks on the future of Syria have been pushed back to July at the earliest. Syrian rebels have abandoned the fight for a strategic area, linking Damascus to the Mediterranean coast. And the Red Cross says it will begin withdrawing some of its international staff from Afghanistan. The UN Special Representative for Syria says an international peace conference to end the civil war will not likely take place until July because the two sides in the conflict are unprepared to commit to a diplomatic solution. Lakhdar Brahimi says he will chair a second round of preparatory talks on June 25th after Russian, U.S., and U.N. officials meeting in Geneva failed to resolve questions about the proposed peace negotiations. VOA correspondent Scott Bobb says the rebels have been chased out of an area called Qusair, which is on the road linking Damascus to the Mediterranean. He says the city is located along a key highway and is close to rebel smuggling routes along the Lebanese border. Here's what Scott Bobb told me when I talked to him about the situation today.
The rebels have not said that they've given up the war. They said that they've lost the battle for Qusair, but the war continues. And this is because Qusair is strategic. One, it's a major link. It lies on the highway between Damascus and the Mediterranean, where there are some of the strongholds that are support President Bashar al-Assad. Two, it lies very close to the border with Lebanon. And on the other side of the border, there is a very large Hezbollah Shiite community that Hezbollah has been using to supply its forces in Syria that are known to be fighting in Qusair. But it's also near a Sunni area where rebels and supporters of the Syrian rebels have been crossing and sending over supplies and evacuating refugees. So it's strategic and it's also contested because of its location in two ways.
We've been talking about this for the last 3 weeks, ever since this battle intensified for Qusair. Would it be safe to say that this is a main road to Damascus, and whoever controls this has a pretty strategic advantage?
Well, it's part of an offensive by the Syrian government to regain certain strategic areas that it lost over the last year or so, and is important for supply lines, for movement of people and troops, and also for psychological reasons. It's likely that you'll see more of these battles. The rebel tactic has been, when they are beaten back, usually because of superior firepower of the Syrian government forces, they regroup and eventually come back. Their strong point is ambushes and urban guerrilla-type warfare. They don't have the warplanes and the artillery that the government forces have, so they just have to withdraw. Meanwhile, the Syrian government does not control probably about half of its territory, so there are large parts of Syria, in the north in particular, that are under control of the rebels. So this is becoming a more intense, a more brutal conflict. And as we can see, the one thing that has changed is the overt presence of several thousand Hezbollah fighters from Lebanon is leading to threats of retaliation by the rebels against Lebanese-located Hezbollah installations. And this is where the risk of the conflict spreading significantly into a neighboring country, at least, rises.
Would it be safe to say this would be a new front in the battle or an expansion of what you have in Syria over the border with Lebanon? This seems to be a particularly ominous development, I would think.
I would call it an ominous development and a ominous expansion and a new factor and a new step in the worsening conflict that's been ongoing for more than 2 years now.
If you look at the ideological battle spilling over into Lebanon, as we've seen in Jordan, as we've seen in Turkey, as we've seen in Iraq, this is going to involve a lot more than just the Syrian mainland. You've got Lebanon. What about the other countries involved? Are they likely to get involved with fighting spilling over on their borders?
Well, they already are involved in supplying the rebels, and they already are involved in it. Their citizens, whether they support the government Shiite-led groups or the rebel Sunni-led groups are sending fighters to fight. And as a result, you have fighters from probably dozens of foreign countries actually engaged in Syria, including from North America and Europe. What happens to these fighters if and when the conflict ends? They go home and spread the same revolution. When you mentioned ideological, I think you were referring to the militant Islamic groups who still relatively small, but are operating under a different ideology, really more of a doctrine. It's a God-mandated cause, and it's not one that you abandon. It's something you are prepared to die for, and is another element that could make this conflict take it to a different level, I should say.
That is VOA's correspondent in Jerusalem, Scott Bobb. The displacement of Syrians by the civil war is a humanitarian disaster which has overwhelmed relief officials. VOA's Elizabeth Arad was recently at the Zaatari refugee camp in Jordan, and she tells us what she found.
The scale of human suffering from more than 2 years of war in Syria is massive. At least 70,000 people have been killed. The United Nations reports the number of Syrian refugees in neighboring countries has passed 1.6 million, and millions more are internally displaced. Jordan has taken in nearly 500,000 Syrians, with some 130,000 finding refuge at the Zaatari camp near the border. The UN's refugee representative, Andrew Harper.
The camp in Zaatari is now the world's second largest refugee camp, and it's only going to go one way. It's only going to get bigger.
Services at the desert haven are overburdened. One woman tells of trying to get an ambulance to come take her sick grandchild for help the day before. She said she had to ask 10 times. And it's not just the refugees who are overwhelmed. Jordan's limited resources are straining under the influx. Analyst Orib Al-Rantawi, director of the Al-Quds Center in Amman, says it's not something Jordan can live with for long.
Why shouldn't we go for a negotiable solution for the refugees issue? Forget about the whole Syrian crisis dimensions.
He wants both sides and their backers to focus solely on this humanitarian issue for now.
Let us provide an agreed-upon areas where the refugees in Syria can live in peace, but not to impose no-fly zones or safe haven, because this is a war declaration.
He believes that having both sides agree on a civilian-only area, not to be used for battle, could be a step in solving the larger conflict. Rantawi concedes it's a matter of political will, and that's a problem those working with refugees have seen all along. The UN's Harper.
It's something which humanitarian agencies get quite impatient on, is just the lack of urgency which the international community puts towards resolving this crisis.
Major powers are planning a peace conference, but it's not yet clear if either side will show up, even as refugee numbers swell. Elizabeth Arad, VOA News, Amman.
The latest developments on what's happening in Syria on our website, voanews.com. Nawaz Sharif has been elected Pakistan's prime minister for an unprecedented third term, nearly 14 years after he was deposed in a military coup. His election to the post today by the country's National Assembly comes after the veteran politicians, Pakistan Muslim League, won a majority of seats in the May 11th national elections. VOA's Sharon Bain covers this story for us from Islamabad.
Honorable Miah Muhammad Nawaz Sharif Saab is declared to have been elected as the Prime Minister of the Islamic Republic of Pakistan.
Lawmakers on Wednesday cheered Pakistan's newly elected Prime Minister Nawaz Sharif, the first politician to lead the country for a third term. Mr. Sharif's political victory represents the first time an elected civilian government in Pakistan has peacefully transitioned to another. Mr. Sharif, in his first public address to the nation as prime minister-elect, said that past dictatorships had weakened the country and democracy was Pakistan's sole way forward. He pledged to end nepotism and resolve the nation's crippling energy shortages.
Load shedding, mehngai, karzon ka pahar,
Mr. Sharif lists a range of issues, including energy shortages, inflation, debt, unemployment, a badly ailing economy, despondency among the youth, extremism and lawlessness, increasing poverty, bleeding public enterprises, rampant corruption, and Pakistan's weak international image. He says, we have accepted responsibility to deal with these challenges. Even though his party enjoys a majority in the parliament, Mr. Sharif also reached out to the opposition, vowing to work together with all political parties to steer the country to a better future. Businessman Hafiz Farooq Ahmed Khan said that as a businessman and veteran politician, the 63-year-old Mr. Sharif has the background necessary to lead Pakistan.
I personally think he would be able to manage the crisis and will come out from this critical situation. I hope and I pray we need leaders, those leaders who are sincere with the nation and with the country.
The country is suffering from a shortage of foreign reserves, chronic corruption, bloody militant attacks, and weak public institutions. Retired military general and analyst Talat Masood says Mr. Sharif is in a strong political position to push through the necessary tough reforms, but warned that the people of Pakistan will need to see results soon.
I think he has enough capital because, firstly, he has a very large majority. He doesn't have to depend on any other party to stay in power. Then, moreover, I think all the other parties also will support him. And the people of Pakistan will support him because they realize that the challenges are enormous. And if he is moving in the right direction, if there is good governance, if they see any hope, they will back him. But if they realize that things are all the same and there is nothing that is changing, obviously then you will find that there will be a lot of unrest.
Mr. Sharif's party, the PMLN, has 176 seats in the 342-member National Assembly, the lower house of parliament. Mr. Sharif also called for an end to controversial American drone strikes within Pakistani territory. The United States says the strikes have weakened al-Qaeda and Taliban militant networks. But they are deeply unpopular among Pakistanis who say the strikes have killed civilians. Sharon Bain, VOA News, Islamabad.
The Red Cross says it plans to pull out some of its international staff from Afghanistan as a result of a recent attack on its office in the eastern city of Jalalabad. The International Committee of the Red Cross began work in Afghanistan more than 25 years ago, and this is the first time one of its offices had been attacked. The aid group has 1,800 employees in Afghanistan who work on projects such as treating war wounded and providing prosthetic devices for those who lose limbs in battle. The U.S. commander in Afghanistan, General Joseph Dunford, says Taliban insurgents are inflicting heavy losses on Afghan national security forces as the Afghans assume the lead position in defending their country. VOA Pentagon correspondent Luis Ramirez reports from NATO headquarters in Brussels.
U.S. Marine Corps General Joseph Dunford spoke to reporters on the sidelines of a gathering where U.S. Defense Secretary Chuck Hagel joined NATO defense ministers to talk about the way forward in Afghanistan as international forces prepare to draw down next year. As that drawdown nears, international troops are taking up more of a support role, and it is the Afghans who are in the lead against the insurgents. Now on the front lines, with international troops only providing backup, the Afghans are at risk for greater losses. Several weeks into the fighting season, General Dunford says the Taliban has done what it said it would do, step up high-profile assaults and insider attacks to create fear and intimidation. He called the losses among Afghan forces significant.
The numbers have been, you know, as I look back over the last 6 or 8 weeks, it's probably, 70. One week it was 44, 34, and then the last 2 weeks have been over 100.
But Dunford said the Afghan forces are exceeding expectations in their ability to take on the insurgents, and he expressed confidence that they are well on their way to being able to defend their country on their own. The general said the only operations still led by U.S. and other international forces include local security patrols, route clearance, and drawdown operations. The high number of Afghan casualties is one reason U.S. military officials want to wait before deciding how many foreign troops should remain in Afghanistan to continue training, advising, and assisting the Afghans after most international troops leave at the end of next year. Dunford said there are a number of things that need to be watched before determining the size of a residual force.
Certainly the performance of the Afghans this summer, the results of the elections in 2014, any political processes that may bring the Taliban into a political process will have an effect on that, which obviously then affects the strength of the insurgency. So I think it's impossible today, except with a linear progression, to project out to 2015 what the security environment is going to be.
U.S. military officials on Tuesday said they are not especially concerned about talks that the Taliban has been holding with Iran, which analysts believe is looking to exert influence on Afghanistan once most international troops depart next year. Brussels is the final stop on a round-the-world trip on which Defense Secretary Hagel is calling attention to threats in cyberspace, which is the focus of a special session at the NATO meeting. The Defense Secretary also used the Brussels visit to reassure NATO partners that the U.S. is able to meet its commitments to the alliance, despite Washington's budget problems. He offered similar reassurances to the U.S. Asian partners during his previous stop at the Shangri-La Dialogue, an annual Asia-Pacific Security Summit in Singapore. Luis Ramirez, VOA News, Brussels.
Thanks for listening, everyone. I'm Paul Westfeeling in Washington. More news and information on our website, MiddleEastVoices.com. That's MiddleEastVoices.com.